Dear listeners, your community radio station could use a new refrigerator. We are looking for a fridge that is no larger than 28 inches deep by 28 inches wide. If you have one, please contact Ani Haynes at 503-231-8032, extension 213, or by email at volunteer@kboo.org to make arrangements. Thanks for helping us keep our food cold while we work hard at producing the best community news, public affairs, and music for the Portland metro area, Cascadia, and the world here at KBOO Portland.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 10:59, going on 11. Time for the dirt bag. Dawn Smallman is here. She's curator of the Portland Eco Film Festival, talking about garden-related films. They'll talk about the honeybee hive, also composting, and the importance of hardening off your veggie starts. And gardening questions are going to be fielded, and big day for tickets, ticket giveaway. So hope you enjoy the show today. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic ingredients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. Also by One Green World, a local nursery offering hard-to-find fruiting plants designed to help you grow your own food and decorate your yard, deck, or patio. To order plants or their 2015 color catalog, their website is onegreenworld.com, or you can reach them by phone at 1-877-353-4028.
Well, good morning. You've reached the second Wednesday of the month. It's time for the dirt bag. Good morning. This is Glenn Andreessen here beside you now until 12 o'clock. Here with me is my guest, Jim Gilbert of One Green World Nursery. Full disclosure, One Green World is an underwriter of this program.
Jim. Good morning, Glenn. Nice to be here.
Indeed. And also our special guest, Dawn Smallman, makes a return.
Hi, Glenn.
And Jim. Return visit. We're here to talk about the different format this year of the Portland Ecofilm series. And we'll talk about that in the first half. And we will have pairs of tickets to give away to three different films there. So we'll have three different questions. And they're not necessarily easy ones. So you're going to earn it this time. We will also have just a brief discussion on compost and composting. This is the time if you want to get started on that. We will talk about planting of fruit trees and fruit bushes, small fruits, as we say. And I'll talk about the, or we'll discuss anyway, the importance of hardening off vegetables. You can't just take them from their sissified environment of the greenhouse and put them outside. You have to harden them off, and tell you a little bit about how we do that. Jim, do you have any announcements?
You know, we're kind of getting honestly through the season now, and so nothing not till fall are there any significant fruit events. We had a really great fruit propagation fair in Canby with the Home Orchard Society. Lots and lots of folks came.
I missed that one.
Oh man, slammed. But it was great. Really, a lot of interesting varieties were available, and a lot of interest. So exciting.
Well, I've got a couple of announcements here. Plant sales. 'Tis the season for plant sales here. One, actually, Neither of these that I have here are local. I mean, local Portland area, but well within our listening range. So we take care of that too. The first one is in Brush Prairie up in Washington. Naturescaping there is once again hosting their annual bare root tree, shrub, and perennial sale. This is on two weekends, April 25th and 26th, and then May 2nd from 10 to 3 at the Wildlife Botanical Gardens located at 11,000 Northeast 149th Street in Brush Prairie, west of the Casey Center. I've actually been there. It's out to the east of town there. Lots of stuff there available. Trees, shrubs, and perennials starting at only $8, $5, and $1 respectively. That's pretty cheap. And Mason Bee cocoons will also be there, 10 for $15. More information, volunteers at naturescaping.org. Coming up the end of this month. Coming up in, let's see, what day is this here? The Wildflower Show in Glide, Oregon. I remember this one was last year, April 25th and 26th. Featuring more than 600 species of Oregon, native Oregon wildflowers. That would be pretty impressive to see that 600 species there. Roving botanists.
the best kind, for sure.
That's right. Also, floral books, posters, and guides for sale. There's a native plant sale from 9 to 5 on Sunday only. And homemade pies, food, and beverages.
That's there. It. That's cool.
Glide Community Center, Glide near Roseburg. Is that about where that is?
It's a short drive.
Anybody know? No. North Umpqua Highway. So, down there.
Yeah.
Wheelchair accessible. I'm sure you can find information if you search for it under Glide Wildflower Show. And finally, locally here, we do have something that I'm kind of involved with here, the Sabin Garden Project. It's a grassroots group that raises awareness about the importance of pollinator habitat. Well, Whole Foods on 15th and Fremont, just that one store, has selected this Sabin Bee Friendly Garden Project to receive bag credit funds starting April 18th and ending July 12th. Here's how it works. Jim, you've probably never heard of this.
Nope.
Okay. When you shop at Whole Foods and bring your own shopping bags, Whole Foods will donate the 5 cents per bag to a community organization. And in this case, it's either the Sabin Garden Project or Xerces. Two wonderful organizations there. You can decide which one to do that there. So when you take your bag there, please remind the cashiers there to donate the bag credit before they complete the transaction. And if you want more information on the Bee Friendly Garden Project, go to sabinpdx.org.
Sounds like a worthy event, worthy cause.
Yeah, well, you know, those 5 cents will add up.
Yep.
Okay, Don, what prompted this change from a once a month to a 4-day extravaganza?
We basically have been sort of operating with the training wheels on, and we pulled them off, and we decided to make the Portland Eco Film Festival a 4-day event. We're going to have semi-monthly screenings the rest of the year round, but starting tomorrow, we're going Thursday through Sunday with a bunch of great environmental and nature films at the Hollywood Theater.
Some of these are garden-related, but not all, of course. And the ones that we will at least focus on a little bit here initially are these garden-related ones. But I'd like you to mention all of them if we have time.
Oh, there's so many. I don't know that you want me to do that, but I'll give you the highlights that I think would be most interesting to your listeners.
Okay.
On Friday night, we've got a film at 9:15 called Les Semeurs, which translates as The Sower. It's a French-Canadian film about a man named Patrice Fortier who founded Les Sociétés des Plantes. And he's a Quebec seed saver and farmer and plant propagator, and he's also an artist. So it's this amazing art film, documentary film, about him and his creations, both the garden and also his artistic works. And primarily he's creating art out of plants and seeds. So there's one scene where he's got a very beautiful photography exhibit of very sexy carrots. It's very sensual shaped carrots and things like that.
I've even grown some like that, I believe. It's pretty remarkable.
It's great. It's also just an interesting view of a Quebec, remote Quebec agrarian community, and they all kind of embrace seed saving and plant love with a playful kind of embrace. And it's a really lovely film. That's on Friday night. On Saturday, we have Just Eat It, A Food Waste Story, which is a husband and wife who are the director and producer of the film. And they basically decide that they're going to try to live off perfectly good food that would otherwise go to waste for close to a year of their life. And you watch them do that. You also watch them go into farms and go into the entire food chain and talk about, why there is so much food waste going on that could otherwise be feeding people.
And here's a teaser here that one of our Garden Stumper questions is going to have to do with that. Okay.
I'm remiss if I didn't say that for Les Amers, we've got the Friends of Portland Community Gardens coming out. They'll have a table at the event. The Hollywood Farmers Market will have a table there too. And at Just Eat It, A Food Waste Story, we're going to have the Oregon Food Bank and Whole Foods on Northeast Sandy, who are going to do a post-film Q&A with us to talk about what they're doing to, you know, feed hungry people with food that would otherwise go to waste. So I want to give them a shout out.
Sure.
On Sunday, we've got an Eco Short Show, which is a series of short films. And there's a couple in there that I think might interest folks. There's one called Funkophilia Rising, which is just about mycologists and people who are just into all sorts of aspects of fungus and the love for fungus. And then we also have a short film that's a profile of Sander Katz. He's the author of The Art of Fermentation, a New York Times bestselling book. And he's a really interesting guy. He calls himself a fermentation fetishist. Yeah. And that one's happening Sunday afternoon at 1:30 as a matinee. So if people want more information, they can come out to they can check out our website, portlandecofilmfest.org.
Are there going to be panel discussions on any following any of these?
There will be a panel discussion after Just Eat It, A Food Waste Story, and after the Eco Shorts. The Food Bank and Whole Foods is going to do the panel after the Just Eat It and after the Eco Shorts. We're going to have a group called Our Children's Trust, which is a legal climate change group that teaches youth how to legally tackle and challenge places like the state of Oregon to meet the climate benchmarks for reducing emissions. So there was actually just a big action here yesterday. Our Children's Trust had a bunch of youth, fourth graders, I believe, testifying at the propane terminal hearing last night. So we're going to have the main person from Our Children's Trust there and talk about how that went yesterday.
Okay. And on Thursday, Friday, is there just one film per day? Or night or evening, whatever?
Thursday and Friday, we just have films in the evening. Saturday and Sunday, we have day and evening films.
Different films?
Yeah.
How many total? It's hard to say.
You're going to stump me. I think it's like 16 or something.
Okay.
Some
are
shorts, some are features.
Yeah.
Big mix.
All right.
Sounds pretty exciting.
It does. This is really opens our eyes as to what people are doing.
Yeah.
Beyond our corner.
You know, it would be really neat if you could bring something like that out to Silverton, for example, where they have a theater a little bit closer to us rural folks, you know. I don't know if you're familiar with the Silverton, the Palace Theater in Silverton. Stu Rasmussen is the owner. He used to be the mayor of Silverton. He's a very cool guy, and it just would be fun to knock on his door and see if he'd be willing to host something.
I'll get his contact info from you. That sounds really interesting. I mean, we're trying to show a lot of films that would appeal to a lot of different people. That's one of the things about scheduling 4 days back-to-back. So, we've got a wide variety, and I think a lot of people, rural and city, would like a lot of the things we're programming.
Okay, that's the Portland Ecofilm Festival at the Hollywood Theater there at Hollywood 40-something and something. No, 40-something and Sandy.
You know, I used to go to the Hollywood Theater when I was a kid. I grew up not too far from there. I used to walk there to watch serials and various things. It's a great place.
It's really on the upswing, too. There's been massive restoration efforts in the past, decade, in particular the last, 6 or 7 years. So it's awesome projection and sound, and it's
and the seats are comfortable.
Yeah,
too.
New seats, new screen, new everything. Yeah. So it's really, and they've actually done a lot of interesting things. There's a lounge upstairs with decor, and so it's a really great place to see films. I think it's having a real renaissance right now, and I'm really happy to be a part of the Hollywood Theater.
Great,
yes, indeed. Okay, we'll Don's going to stick around here because shall we do our first garden snipper now, Jim?
Sure.
Okay. Well, Don suggested this one, and it has to do with the food waste film. What's the name of that one again?
Just Eat It, A Food Waste Story.
Just Eat It, and that will be on?
Saturday, this weekend at 4 p.m.
So the first person that gets the correct answer to this question will have a pair of tickets waiting for them on the guest list for the 4 p.m. show of this Just Eat It.
So the question is, in North America, what is the typical amount of perfectly good food that is sent to waste?
And we're asking to be within 10% of this number. So like if it was 1% of the food waste, then you would have from, well, zero.
Minus nine.
0 to 11, right. I don't want to give anything away. So if you know the answer to that question or you want to just take a guess, 503-231-8187. Why don't we go to our first musical interlude here? And I thought this was kind of fun. We're talking about pawpaws here, right? So
we are?
Well, we're going to. Well. That's our plant of the month coming up right after this. And so all of our tunes today have to do with daddy.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, pawpaw.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah. So, all right. First one is old. The Who, something they didn't even write, so that's why it's old. Daddy Rolling Stone, The Who. I'm not even sure what album that's from. It's just that I have a, I don't know how many CD set it is of all the Rolling Stone stuff, or The Who stuff, so.
And that you remember where that is. And that
oh, I can search for it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I'm impressed.
Okay, Tammy, are we going to the phones? Okay, caller, you're on the dirt bag. You have a question or an answer for us?
Hopefully the answer.
Okay.
10 million tons.
Well, we were just looking for a percentage, but is that close, Don?
I only know it as a percentage.
We only know it as a percentage. Okay, caller, what's the percentage there? Take a guess as the percentage.
40%.
Oh, that's right on the money, honey.
Ding, 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 ding.
That's right.
Whoa, really?
Yep, that's right. So, you mean it's crazy that you won, or it's that high?
Oh, it's
both.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me, but that's shocking.
Yeah,
yep.
Yeah, that's why we wanted to bring this to light here.
Jeez.
Yeah. So, caller, if you stay on the line, Tammy will take your name down and we'll put it on the guest list for that.
Awesome! Thanks so much for your great show.
You bet. Thanks for calling. Okay, Tammy says we have two other callers there. Let's see what they're if they have anything to add to us. Good morning.
Hi, I was going to say the same percentage.
You were going to say 40% too. Ah, yep. Darn. Well, we'll have two more questions here. So, that's it. Okay, we'll go on here. So, sorry to the other callers, but we'll have more questions coming up.
And there's nothing to stop folks from going to see the films.
That's right.
Anyway, you know.
Right.
It's pretty astounding, that film. You actually see, you know, what it means for a piece of fruit to pass by the approval process. Like the banana has to have a certain length. It has to have a certain curve. It can't be marred. And you just watch, like, people taking produce from farms, you know, into these conveyor belts, and all the peaches coming down the line that are rejected. And it's just an astounding visual. The film's really good at delivering lots of information visually in very entertaining ways. And it's a pretty playful film too, for such a serious topic. But,
well, in all fairness, I'm assuming that, you know, for peaches or whatever, they'd juice those, or who knows what else they would do. I don't think they would just throw them all away.
You'd be surprised. Come out to the film.
You wouldn't do anything like that with your produce.
Well, homegrown produce, we eat it.
Right. In fact, we are eating some of Jim's home-dried figs.
Yeah, Desert King figs. Really, really good. And I discovered them in the freezer the other day. I thought, hey, what are those doing in there?
I got by
to eat them.
Okay, well, our plan of the month is pawpaws. We'll learn all about pawpaws here. We've talked about pawpaws in the past, because I remember talking about pawpaw gelato.
Mm. Did I bring some in?
You did.
I did.
Yeah, that was pretty tasty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the there aren't too many Native American fruits, tree fruits, that are popular and quite edible. In fact, I think one of our stumpers is going to be about another one, not the pawpaw.
Right, that's right.
So, but I think we should talk about pawpaw, because it is it has a lot of history. It goes back, way back in the day. It was reputedly eaten by Lewis and Clark when they were traveling through Missouri in the part of the expedition, a fruit that has, it's kind of an escape from a tropical group of plants, fruits, cherimoya being one of them, which some people are familiar with that, but pawpaw's hardy, so you can grow it in, actually even in southern Canada, up in southern parts of Ontario, where it's native, and all up the eastern seaboard and in the middle part of America. So names like the Nebraska banana and Michigan banana. There's even a Pawpaw River in Michigan. So it's well known name wise in those regions. But interestingly, a lot of the people who live where pawpaw grows don't know anything about it. And so there's a few of us little aficionados out there, you know, trying to let people know that there's this really cool Native American fruit that people should be eating more of. And there are some interesting varieties that have been, they're old varieties selected out of from people just walking around in the woods. And then also some newer ones from some breeding work that's been done. Continuing, Kentucky State University has a really interesting program with pawpaw. And so it's one of those fruits that's just coming on, and I think someday you might even see it in marketplaces.
Well, the last year seemed to be a darn good pawpaw year here.
Yep,
I had more pawpaws last year than I've ever had.
That's great.
I didn't reach my saturation point. Dawn, have you ever had a pawpaw?
I haven't, and I'm from Indiana, and I know they grow there, and I've always wanted to have one, but I've never seen one in a market for sale or at a farmer's market even. Where's the place to go?
Well, I have a really good friend in Indiana that grows them in Terre Haute. But to get them here, actually, that's a great question. The All About Fruit Show in October, late October, in Canby at the fairgrounds, sponsored by the Home Orchard Society. We actually have a booth there, and we bring pawpaws to eat fresh, plus usually have gelato, and you can come and try them.
How are pawpaws propagated?
Typically, well, we bud them or graft them.
So there's rootstock for
We grow the rootstock from pawpaw seeds, and then we graft the variety on top of that.
And we need two?
You should have
two varieties?
Two varieties for pollination.
You remember our discussion from last month, we talked about pollinizers. That is the other tree.
That's right. That's right. The partner.
The other man.
In this case, the pawpaw flower is a perfect flower, has both male and female parts, but the pollen of that particular variety is not compatible with the same female flower. I mean, it's female part of the flower, so that's why you have to have another variety.
So it can't fertilize the female, right?
The mm-hmm. female part mm-hmm. of that same flower.
Right. So we need another variety, not just another plant, but another variety.
That's right. That's right. And of course, they both bear fruit, so uh-huh. you don't lose anything by having both trees. And the pawpaw flower is sort of interesting because it's dark purple, and it's not pollinated by bees.
Yeah, that bums me out.
But, but there are the insect, whatever insects are doing, it seems to do their job. The old timers had stories about hanging roadkill in the tree to attract flies, but we don't do that.
Is it flies that generally do the pollination, or can it be beetles or mosquitoes or moths or butterflies? Or, I mean, those are all right. pollinizers.
Flies are reputed to be the main pollinator. Yeah, yeah. And I'm not sure exactly why that is, but that seems to be what does the job.
Well, why did we have a good year last year? What's your speculation?
Well, first place, we had a nice spring where we didn't have late frost that hurt the flowers, so we had lots of flowers.
So sometimes that's what does them in?
That can inhibit the...
When's the bloom period?
It's late, fairly late, April.
Not yet?
No, it's a long ways yet. The end of this month, probably.
Yeah, this month is really shaping up to be kind of typical now.
We've had a little setback, haven't
cool.
we?
Cool, right. Well, not about setback, but just kind of a plateau.
Right. Well, I was expecting to have, peaches in June, but but not anymore.
Yeah.
Flies do the job, and you can do it yourself, too, and, which is sort of interesting because if you have a flower, a pawpaw, and you look at the flower, look inside it, there's the female parts in the center of the flower, as is typical, and then surrounding it's kind of a roundish area, which is the male part, and the male part blooms before the female is receptive. Mm-hmm. So you have mm-hmm. to move flowers back and forth depending upon that the male pollen from a different flower and different tree, bring it to a female that is now receptive. It's past the male has passed bloom in it, male parts.
How can you tell that is it obvious that it's not open yet?
The flower opens, and then this rounded area becomes a bunch of stamens, and it grows out, and then they all sort of fall off, and then the female part is then receptive, and it's kind of sticky in the center too, so the pollen sticks right onto it.
Sticky stigma.
Yeah,
there you go. I remember that.
Yeah. And a lot of people, we do some hand pollinating just for fun, but this...
Usually it gets that Mother Nature can
typically can it. Seems to do it okay.
Yeah.
A lot of people wonder what the fruit tastes like, because, of course, that's the issue why we need to have some ways to have people sample them. Once in a while, one year we had enough fruit, we actually sold it. We had a couple different markets around town. I think Food Front and People's both had pawpaw fruit, and this year we have enough. Perhaps we can do that again. Then we send out an email to folks and say, hey, go check this out. And they're deluged with folks. And they
sell out right away.
A few hours. And then
Well, what are the growing requirements and space... Light.
If you've got, you can put them pretty close together. They're not a real big tree in our climate. In the East Coast, where they have like these hot nights, they'll get up to be, like, I've seen 20-foot tall pawpaw trees, probably maybe even taller than that. But biggest ones I've seen around here are around maybe 12 feet. You can put them 8 feet apart or a little further than that apart. They like full sun. The half-day sun is okay. They need to be close enough, of course, so the flies can move back and forth between them. Like nitrogen, so a good fertile soil, they'll appreciate that. It's also, if you have them in a really bright, sunny area, it's a good idea to paint the trunk to reflect the sun, so because they seem to be susceptible to sunburn on the southwest side, particularly. So what we do is we take interior latex white paint, we mix it half and half with water, and we paint up to the bottom branch. Now, a young tree up to 1 or 2 years old isn't going to have a problem, but when they get older, I think that's important. If the tree has a lot of lower branches, it will shade the trunk. It's not, you don't have to do it. But if it's got a fairly bare trunk, that's a good idea.
Okay. And they are planted, as bare root?
Typically potted.
Potted, okay.
Yeah. They're more a little more difficult to transplant bare roots, so we found that the potted plants have better success rate.
Okay. Well, it's a taste treat unlike any other that we can grow around here.
Very tropical.
And the seeds are smooth and large.
Like big beans, big flat beans.
Yeah, lima beans, black.
Right. Don't eat them, though.
They'd probably slip down pretty easily.
they say that actually there's compounds in the seeds in the skin that have been some research done on anti-cancer properties, but the recommendation is not to eat them.
Okay.
Better to just eat the flesh.
Never heard of anyone dying from eating a pawpaw seed.
And how many
choking, maybe.
And how many people have you heard about that have eaten pawpaw seeds?
Zero.
Right.
So either the warning has really taken effect, or I'm always reminded of that, you know, it must be a myth that cats get stuck in trees, as evidenced by the lack of cat skeletons in trees.
Right. That's good, Glenn.
All right. Okay. Okay, so that's pawpaws. All right.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll continue with our garden stumper themes here based upon that. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Okay, so pawpaw is one of a very select number, a very small number of large American trees, Native American trees that bear an edible, tasty fruit that is popular, quite popular in its native range.
So we can rule out, you know, hawthorn or something like that. Well, right. Well, we can eat the berries, but...
Yeah, and they're not... I wouldn't call them popular.
No.
And I wouldn't call oaks popular.
Right, because
I wouldn't call out a fruit even, but...
We're talking about fruit, not
a
nut.
Fruit, right.
Right.
And I'm sure that some of the listeners out there already know this answer
because
they've heard me talk about it before. But anyway, I...
But have there been tickets at stake?
Never. Okay.
Okay, so which film will this be for, Don?
Oh, for Les Semeurs, The Sower, which is showing on Friday night.
Okay, so if you know the name of the other Native American fruit tree, give us a call, 503-231-8187. And meanwhile, we will continue with our pawpaw theme, or at least our daddy theme, from, this is William Clark. William Clark called Daddy Pinocchio.
Just call on Daddy Pinocchio. Well, and when
William Clark hit a groove there.
And we were discussing if that could be the William Clark that ate pawpaws in the Lewis and Clark expedition. Probably not.
But yeah, we think not. That's from the Blind Pig Records 25th Anniversary Collection. I don't know when that was. 2001 or something like that, right? Yeah, whenever the 25th anniversary was. Okay, we have Philip on the line for the Garden Stumper. Good morning, Philip.
Oh.
There's Philip.
Is it the persimmon?
It is the persimmon.
All right. That's right.
Great job there, folks.
All right, that was almost a gimme, wasn't it? All right, Philip, are you interested in going to the film?
What day is it?
Yeah.
Friday night at 9:15 at the Hollywood Theater.
Yes.
Okay, Philip, stay on the line. Give your name to Tammy.
All right, thank you.
And we'll put your name on the list. Thank you, Philip.
Thank you.
Okay, persimmon, the American persimmon.
Yes, and you know, a really wonderful fruit, and not well known. And I'm one of a few people advocating strongly for some research to go on. And I just actually got a little bite recently from Kentucky State, so they're going to take this on because it's a tree and fruit that needs more research and development. And there's actually a persimmon festival in Mitchell, Indiana, every year. People gather it and sell it for persimmon pulp in the Midwest.
You know, one thing that we didn't discuss, and that is pests and disease of pawpaw. Are they pretty, you know, native plant tends to be?
Yeah, nothing bothers it in our experience. We don't have any problems.
See? It's another reason.
Yeah.
Right there.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's move on here to... We'll get to the vegetable side of things now, and talking, since it's tis the season of getting things out into the garden, hardening off is a practice that needs to be done. It doesn't necessarily need to take a long time. I can tell you what I do, and then sometimes what the experts say. But as I mentioned, if your plants have been inside or in a greenhouse, it's pretty protected there. Now, there may be some wind, and there may be some sun, but not of the same... intensity that you would get if you just took them from inside and put them outside. Your leaves could get scalded, or the wind could just topple them, or if you got a little rain, that could bend them. And once that little delicate stem kinks, breaks, or bends, there's no turning back. So the recommendation is to take them out incrementally for longer periods of time. I mean, if you know, first day an hour or so, second day 2 hours, whatever. I've been taking mine out all the time now, every day if it's nice enough and not going to be pouring down rain. So they're getting hardened off. That's just what we call it. The tomatoes are 3 or 4 inches, and the broccoli is even more than that. Actually, the broccoli can go outside now. I just haven't done it yet, but peppers, all of these things that have been inside, take them outside gradually to get them hardened off and stressed. That's what we want. Stressed plants. We don't want nice, leggy plants.
Succulent.
No, we don't want that.
Ready to eat.
We don't want that yet. We want them to be able to survive on their own without any babying for us. So that's that. The other topic that I'd like to discuss a little bit is composting, because there are fewer things that you can, there aren't very many things that you can do without in the garden, and compost is one of those. Sunlight is the other. You can get by with, you know, for a while by artificial fertilizers or lights or whatnot, but eventually you have to feed the microorganisms that are in the soil, and that's what compost does for us. So it's an important thing to do. Doesn't have to be hard. One of my sayings is that you can speed up the process and you can slow it down, but you can't stop it. So you're going to be successful. You don't necessarily need a bin. A bin can help contain it and maybe makes it look a little nicer if you have a concern of that nature. Rodents are always a question that comes up. If you're only composting yard debris, you will have many fewer problems. The compost bins that are sold as bins, for example, by Metro, and you can get very reasonably priced compost bins at their paint store on Swan Island for $45 or $60, and they are rodent resistant. Realize that, you know, hardly anything is totally resistant from rodents. They are remarkable chewers and can squeeze into very small spaces. So, but if you're not putting in food, to repeat myself, and just yard debris, you will have many fewer problems. And I think I'd recommend that to start out with. If you do want to compost your food scraps, then think about a worm bin, which would be inside. You generally can have inside. And the material that you get from a worm bin, the compost, the vermicompost, is very rich in nutrients, which will help the microorganisms, which will in turn help your plants. See, I've always said here, you know, what we're doing with compost is we're feeding the soil, the microorganism in the soil, and let them feed the plants. We're not feeding the plants directly, so to speak. And that's the cycle that we want to talk about.
That's the difference between compost and artificial fertilizer, which does the other thing, feeds the plants, but not the soil.
Right, and as farmers in the Midwest and other places have learned, that eventually you end up with sterile soil. Sterile meaning there's just no life in it.
I have a question for you guys. We have this film, Fungophilia Rising, in our shorts program, and they talk a lot about how fungus establishes this web of life in the soil. Can you guys explain the relationship between that and compost? Are you more likely to encourage more of that web if you're putting compost down?
Certainly. Fungus feeds on the, you know, smaller microorganisms, they absorb nutrients because they have very strong acids and enzymes that when they wrap their tendrils, if we will, around them, the hyphae, these white tendrils that you'll see in the soil, they can secrete these enzymes that will, and acids and whatnot, that will dissolve, if you will, hard pieces of wood. You know, a tree falls in the forest and it might be still real hard for decades. But eventually it comes to the point where you can just kick it apart. And the reason that, you know, it's rotting, well, what's rotting it is the fungus. Oh. And most of the, depending on what you're growing there, determines what the percentage of bacteria versus fungus is in the soil. If we're planting leafy vegetables, then we want a bacterially dominated soil. And we can give it bacterially dominated compost. But if you're growing fruit trees or fruit bushes or perennials, that tends to be fungally dominated soil, and we'd want a fungally dominated compost. So you would tend to you might want to compost more woody material, but still it would be compost. So you'd be putting in twigs and branches or wood chips or sawdust or things like that would encourage fungal growth. But if you were going to use compost to feed to your lettuce, for example, then we would want to put in bacterially dominated compost. And that means that you would be adding to your compost pile more kitchen scraps or manure or grass clippings. But still, we need to keep this ratio in mind of the carbon and nitrogen in the soil or in the compost. And we don't want too much of any one thing. So I don't want you to remember Uncle Len said something about, yeah, I want food scraps and manure and grass clippings, but we cannot have that exclusively. We'll just say, well, we want, if we want fungally dominated soil, we might have, two parts of carbon, which means leaves or twigs or sawdust, to one part nitrogen, you know, manure, grass clippings, food. And if you want bacterially dominated one, just the other way around, maybe one to one, one mm-hmm. part grass clippings to one part leaves, mm-hmm. for example. And, you know, most people aren't going to do that. So fine. You know, like I said, you know, you can speed it up or you can slow it down, but you can't stop it. And you'll have a fine garden anyway. It just won't be the optimum that it could be. But optimum or pretty good is good enough for me.
One of the things that we've worked on is using like sort of what's sort of in between woody material and grass clippings are things like straw,
mm-hmm.
you know, which can aerate otherwise soggy material, like if a lot of wood, kitchen scraps and so forth. They get anaerobic. Sometimes they get too dense, you know, and so yeah. you can mix in some fibrous material, but wood is slow to break down. So,
well, the other part of compost is the surface area that you have, you know, the size of the particles that are in the compost bin. The smaller it is, the more surface area you'll have. And so, of course, you're going to have a lot more room at the chow table for the bacteria and the fungus to start eating, dissolving, so to speak, and then absorbing these nutrients. Mm-hmm. And then changing physically or chemically the forms of the nutrients that they partake in, you know, whatever they absorb. And by then it changes into the form that plants can use. So when they poop or when they die or they get eaten, then those nutrients are freed up so plants can use them.
Yep.
It's just a wonderful, wonderful cycle.
Natural process.
Nutrient cycling is what we call it. So, yep. Okay, let's go to the phones here. Huh? Shut up, Glenn. Oh, Beverly, you're yes. with the Dirtbag.
Yes, and I think I heard you say the name of the seed company, but I've missed it. That's the one you main?
Yes, Fedco.
How do you spell it?
Fed, F-E-D.
Oh, that's
C-O,
right.
Fedco.
Okay,
right.
Great.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Tammy great. Brought that in here, too, and asked that question.
And that's fine. But also, I actually bury my just greens. I don't compost.
That's an excellent suggestion.
I've done that. And so I just, it seems to be easier. And I just wondered what you thought about that, because I think some people, you know, have trouble turning their compost.
Mm-hmm.
And so that doesn't sound too weird.
Oh, heck no. No, just direct soil incorporation. Just bury your waste. And that's a great way to prevent rodent problems. You know, mm-hmm. you have to bury it deep enough. You know, you don't want,
right.
you want more than 1 or 2 inches of soil on top of it.
Yeah,
because
right.
they can certainly
right.
get to it. But
that's an
excellent suggestion on just bury your waste. Now, mm-hmm. the problem is, the drawback is, it's not a problem, mm-hmm. is that you can't plant in that area right away unless you're burying it.
Oh, right.
If we're talking vegetables or something like that.
Yeah.
But
right.
but you could bury it around your fruit trees or mm-hmm. something like that. Just,
yeah,
you know,
right.
not too close. But I do that occasionally when I find
great.
A dead
great.
Possum.
Okay. Well, I so very much appreciate your show.
Sure. Great.
Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
And thanks for calling. All right. Okay. It's time for our daddy roll. We're here. I'm here with Don Smallman, the curator. Is that the right term? I use that term, curator.
Sure.
For the Hollywood, or at the Hollywood, but the Portland Eco Film Festival, and Jim Gilbert, who's usually here. You going to
yes.
be here next month?
I think so. Yeah.
All right.
I might be gone in September. I've just signed up to go to a fig conference in Italy.
Wow. Jealous.
Is there room for us?
Yeah, that's pretty special. So, but I might have to miss September, but right now it looks like I'm here until then.
Good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's continue on here. This is Roosevelt. Jeez, what did I write down here? Booba. Roosevelt Booba Barnes. This is called Rockin' Daddy. Rockin' Daddy, Roosevelt Booba Brown, Barnes, excuse me. Okay, we have one final pair of tickets. And what film will this be to, Don?
It'll be to our Eco Shorts short film program on Sunday at 1:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater.
And how many shorts are there?
Five.
How many
and a panel.
How many shorts are bunched up here? Yeah. Sorry, that's a pun.
We'll also be giving away our award announcement for our short film best film award at that time.
And how is that determined?
By the people who are watching the films and programming the films, and just coming to consensus about we'll give that to.
All right,
great.
Okay, so Jim is on a roll here. This we're going to stay with native plants again, or native Oregon plants.
Right, we're going to narrow it down a little bit.
Yes.
And this shouldn't be too hard, but no. We'd like to hear somebody can think of three native Oregon berries that taste good.
I mean, yeah,
not,
edible.
Not something, right. Some, yeah.
Right, and there's a difference edible. Between taste good and edible. Because Oregon grape, you can eat them, but
yeah,
they don't necessarily. You need some processing for that. These you can just eat right off the bush.
Right. All right. Let's try to find three of those out there.
Right.
And there could be some variation in that edibility too. You know, I mean,
sure.
Depending upon people's experiences. But you could go Native Americans ate them, and that would be a good test.
Right. And we can tell you. I'll just give you a hint here. I'll give you one that it's not, like blueberry.
That's correct.
We don't know. I don't know of an Oregon native blueberry. Is there?
No,
I mean, there are in the United States, like Maine, there's some, you know, high bush or low bush blueberries and whatnot, but that's not one of them, but that's what we're after here.
Yeah.
Kind of like that.
Right. And common names are always challenging too, because somebody could say blueberry, well, you know, we won't talk about the other names for the various berries that resemble blueberries.
Right. Well, it's blue. No, that's not what we're talking about. Okay. So, you know, the number 503-231-8187. This is for a pair of tickets to the 130 Eco Shorts.
On Sunday
at the Hollywood Theater. Okay. Jim, we have a few minutes here to talk about planting.
Yeah.
Because we could talk about planting every month because it's kind of different for whatever month you choose.
It is. And we're right now, I would say, this first part of April, I mean, we want to get the bare root plants in the ground soon. Potted plants can be planted later. I mean, you can plant, we've planted bare root fruit trees as late as mid-May, even sometimes later than that. But it's nice to get them in the ground sooner because then the rain, and we still have rain, and we still have cool temperatures for them to get established before there's a lot of stress from heat and dryness and all that. So,
bare root, your timing on bare root is running out, we'll say.
Yeah, it's time to get going.
Yeah.
You know, let's get them in there. And of course, that's, I think, myself, we grow a lot of plants in pots and transplant them that way, but a bare root fruit tree to me, I like better than a potted fruit tree.
Mm-hmm.
I don't rule out potted fruit trees, but a bare root fruit tree, the root system is already set up to go out into the soil, where a potted tree, you have to do more work to get the roots torn away from the circling in the pot. And so that's just a little extra effort you have to go to.
And the bare roots are generally a better bang for your buck because they don't have the labor. The nurseries don't have labor wrapped up in potting it and hauling it and whatever. So
there's a couple of basic principles that apply to this. And one is you have to dig a decent sized hole. I mean, think for a moment about a potted plant, for example, where people might say, hey, you know, I got this gallon plant. I remove the gallon pot. I dig a hole exactly the size of the gallon pot, and I just insert the plant. Not a good idea.
Yeah.
No, don't want to do that. And with bare root plants, the same thing. You want to make a big enough hole so the roots have some room to get out and grow. And the whole, one of my ideas, you don't make the plant fit the hole, you make the hole fit the plant.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got a really long root that's going out some distance, you don't necessarily need to dig a trench to put that little that root in. You can just sort of cut it back. And
so, prefer to cut it back rather than wrap it around, for example.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wrapping around is not advised.
Okay.
Because you want the roots to go out from the center of the plant, the trunk. So that's important, of course, is to have a decent sized hole. Another big issue comes up. People constantly ask me about this. What should I put in the planting hole? And they talk about, you know, they've got bags of this and that they want to stick in there. They've got bad soil. They've got clay soil. They're really worried about this. Well, the plant's going to be in that location for its lifetime, and it really will do better if the soil surrounding the roots is the same as the soil that it's going to be living in all the way out.
Mm-hmm.
So we recommend don't put anything in the planting hole that you didn't take out of it. Just put it all back in.
Well, maybe big rocks or something.
Right, those are big rocks.
Yeah, you leave those out.
Yeah, you could do that. Generally speaking, put the same soil back in the hole that came out of it. Another issue is making sure the plant's at the right depth. On a fruit tree, for example, if you look above the last root, you'll normally see a change in color, maybe faint, but you'll see it where the plant was in the soil in the nursery. And that level, it shouldn't be any deeper than that in the new hole that's in. Sometimes it's hard to determine where that is because you're trying to sight across an open mm-hmm, hole in the ground. Mm-hmm. So we'll take a board or something and put across there to make sure that we get that point pretty accurate.
Lay your shovel.
You can lay your shovel down, anything to make a line, some guide for you. Some plants can get hurt by planting too deeply. Kiwis, for example, will die sometimes from that. And the other bad thing with a dwarf fruit tree, for example, if you plant it too deeply and you get the soil up around where the graft or bud is, you can actually, instead of having the dwarfing rootstock be controlling the size of the tree anymore, the top part mm-hmm. of the tree will root into the soil, and now you'll have a full-size fruit tree. Surprise, Mabel!
So it's not what I wanted.
Yeah. So, I mean, those are sort of the basic things. Then, of course, it's important to water the plant in, but once it's watered in after you've planted it, leave it alone, because we're in moist weather this for another month at least. Well, there's no leaves coming out from the plant. There's no transpiration going on. And the worst thing we can do, in my opinion, is to overwater and actually drown the base of the plant.
My bee buddy, Tim, and I had a discussion about what would be an appropriate way or manner to make sure that that there's no air bubbles or pockets left. I mean, how do you tamp the soil down, or do you step on the soil?
I do. First, I work it in with my hands around the
roots.
Plant to make sure it's getting underneath and all. If mm-hmm. Another thing that you can do if you've got a fairly fibrous root system is make a little mound in the center of the hole and drape the roots out from the mm-hmm. side around mm-hmm. that mound. But work the soil in around the roots. Once you've got it, the hole pretty full, you know, tamp on it with your foot. You don't need to like stop or jump up and down, but right. firm it down.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's get to the phones here and see if we can get three wild native berries.
Okay.
All right. Chris, good morning.
Hi. First, the vine trailing blackberry.
Yeah, there is a native wild blackberry.
It's wonderful. It's a real nuisance, but it tastes really great. Yeah. There's the red and blue huckleberries. The red is native here. Uh-huh. I've got a few in my yard. I love them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Two for two.
And there's in what I have in my yard, the last one is, I believe, a wild strawberry. Salal.
Salal?
Salmon berries. Pardon me?
Yeah. Did you mention Salal?
Yeah.
Yeah. And salmon berries, you said, too.
Salmon berry.
So that's it.
If the tiny strawberry is wild or not, it's certainly. There is a
coastal strawberry.
Mm-hmm.
It's native here? It's native to Oregon.
Chiloensis, I think, is mm-hmm, the Latin mm-hmm. name of it.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Yeah, there's a lot. And right. Those are all really good answers.
And there's others.
Thimbleberry.
Yes. Thimbleberry, yeah.
You know,
yes.
Really great, great berry, you know. And I've had this thoughts for years, you know, one only reason that these berries aren't cultivated is because nobody's gone out to choose and select the best ones. And I bet you could, we could have thimbleberry orchards in Oregon if we're...
Absolutely. One time when my husband was young, he made a thimbleberry jam. He said it was like, it took him forever. He had like a little
Yeah.
Half a cup of jam or something.
Well, okay, well, that's great.
So stay on the line, and Tammy, we'll get your name, and we'll put you on the guest list for the 1:30 showing of the Eco Shorts.
Hey, this is Tammy in the air room.
Yeah.
What was I going to ask you? What is the film and what time?
It's Eco Shorts. It's a bunch of short films, Sunday, April 12th at 1:30 for that last one.
So you said five or so shorts?
Five shorts. Yeah.
Five shorts there.
And the panel.
So there's many different ones. Got it. Okay, Don Smallman, thank you very much.
Thanks so much to both
of you. It's always a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks
and
to your listeners.
We look forward to, hopefully I can make it to some of those shows. Jim?
Yeah, it's been great at being here. I'm not sure I'm going to make it to the shows, but yeah,
it's a busy season there.
Yeah, a lot going on.
So. You can use our program to figure out what to watch the rest of the year. Home viewing.
Or maybe go out to Silverton. And
let's talk about that.
Great.
Okay, Tammy, you're the best, and you're on there. This is Glenn Andreessen. We'll be back in 5 weeks this time. Get that extra week this time. So thanks for listening. Be well. We'll see you at the movies. No, somebody already says that, don't they? Yeah.
It's noon. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Deakum Street Doorway, a Linton feed and seed store offering essentials for farm life in the city, including animal feeds, plants from local farms and nurseries, and seed potatoes, onion sets, and chicks. Open Thursday through Sunday, 10 to sundown at Northeast Deakum and 8th, deakumstreetdoorway.com. Also by Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic